Blog Talk Radio.
We don't get fooled again.
Welcome to Relational Harm Reduction Radio. I'm Sandra Brown with the Institute for Relational Harm Reduction and Public Pathology Education. Thank you for joining us tonight as we will be looking at and exploring pathological love relationships and aspects pertaining to that. Tonight we have a special program in which we are going to be talking about the differences between normal anger and pathological anger. If you would like to find out more information about the Institute or products or services, please go by our website at saferelationshipsmagazine.com or check out our book, Women Who Love Psychopaths, How to Spot a Dangerous Man, or Counseling Victims of Violence. And tonight I'm joined by Jennifer Young with her tonight as my co-host. Tonight, and as I say, every day via the Institute, is our licensed mental health counselor and director of survivor services. Good evening, Jennifer.
Hey, Sandra. Hey, everybody. Looking forward to a good show tonight.
I am too. And I know that this is of a lot of importance to our survivors who. Really struggle with trying to understand the differences between normal anger and pathological anger. So looking forward to that. Before I forget, if people want to call in and talk to our guests tonight, who I'll be introducing in a moment, our call-in line number is 347-989-1271. In that line, you can call in for questions, or it's also a listening line. So if you just want to call in and listen, you can do that. And we invite your listening or your questions. Before I forget, we have one more retreat coming up in September. If you are interested, find out more information about our Healing the Aftermath of Pathological Love Relationships retreat in beautiful land of the waterfalls, Brevard, North Carolina, in September. Go by our website. It's such a great retreat. Okay, well, tonight we have a special guest. Dr. Gina Simmons is joining us tonight. She's the co-director at Schneider Family Services and is a licensed mental health therapist with over 24 years of experience providing counseling and consulting services. She has been a contributor to Women in Crime blog, which was dubbed as by the Wall Street Journal as a blog worth reading, and has previously written for Forbes.com as well as her own blog. Thank you for joining us tonight, Dr. Simmons.
Thank you for having me, Sandra. And it's nice to meet you too, Jennifer.
Yep, glad you're here, Gina. I really look forward to talking a little bit about this and helping folks kind of understand some differences between that normal and pathological anger thing. It's a pretty complicated issue.
It is, and it's complicated. Yeah, it's complicated for us professionals to find that line too.
Dr. Simmons works in the field of anger management and anger treatment. And I know for a lot of our listeners, perhaps in a slightly different context, their partners may have gone through anger management and anger treatment. And for a lot of our listeners out there, they may not even understand what that treatment is. And I think for so many of us, we get the wrong message about anger. We think, you know, all anger is bad. instead of understanding sort of what constitutes normal and then when does it cross over that line. So help us out here. Help us understand what, you know, let's start with normal. What is normal in anger?
That's a great question, and actually there have been some studies on that, so I can give you some pretty good data. But actually, in a normal family, a normal household, you might get angry several times a week. And that anger might even consist of yelling and screaming. And about less than 10% of the time, there would be some kind of physical aggression, and we're talking low-level aggression, like throwing something against the wall or slamming your hand down on a table, you know, that kind of thing. We're not talking aggression like hurting someone or hitting someone. So normal anger does tend to flare up really quickly. For example, you have a teenage child, you come home, you've told that teenage child the dishes need to be cleaned. You find the child watching television, the dishes aren't clean, and you need to make dinner, and so you yell at your teenager. You know, this is something that typically happens in most households. Or you might shout at your spouse because you needed them to do something for you and they didn't do it, and you're really hurt and disappointed. So it typically flares up really quickly and then calms down relatively quickly. For example, you might yell at your teenager. A teenager says, you know, give me a break, and you have a little bit of a back and forth, and then you get to some understanding after that about what needs to happen, and then later on in the evening you might hug and kiss your teenager goodnight or kiss your partner goodnight, and everybody's fine. So that's really what normal anger looks like in a home, and it's usually triggered by some rational event that a reasonable person could point to and say, yes, that was rude behavior. Your teenager should have done this. Or there's some rational component to the anger where a reasonable person could sort of understand why you would get angry. So it's there also to anger is there to tell us something's wrong. So it's really something we need for our survival as human beings. We need to be alerted when we're hurt or when something's wrong or when someone is upsetting us. It tells us that there's something in the relationship we need to work on or fix. And if we didn't have that, sort of like physical pain, if we didn't have physical pain, we would really hurt ourselves and damage ourselves. And some people have that condition and they can actually die from it. So physical pain is sort of there as a signal that something's wrong and we need to ease up. But emotional pain is the same way, and anger is sort of one of those things that signals us. And it tells us then to do something. It motivates us to do something to make that discomfort go away. And so that serves a real healthy function in relationships. It also is really good for couples to have a little bit of conflict, because it helps them get closer. It helps you understand what that other person is about and what they care about and what hurts their feelings, and can really lead to better intimacy with your partner.
And I know so many of our clients, I'm thinking about particularly our listeners, are people are coming out of these pathological love relationships, as we call them, in which their partners have had chronic anger.
Right.
You normally associated with cluster B type personality disorders, narcissism, sometimes borderline personality disorder, antisocial, even worse, into narcissists. Into the psychopathies. And so a lot of our listeners, perhaps their parents were cluster B, or they are in a relationship with cluster B, and may have developed, you know, a real fear around the expressions of anger, because, you know, very often in cluster B, there is so much of that anger. And so I know a lot of people, you know, struggle with even believing anger is normal anymore because it has been so, you know, blown out of proportion in the communication dynamics of their everyday life with that. And so they're probably thinking, man, that would be great to just have, you know, common kinds of negative interactions where what they're used to are some of the extremes. And so there really is pathological anger.
Exactly. And that anger also might flare up quickly. I think one of the things that differentiates normal behavior of any type from pathological behavior is you look at extreme. How extreme is it? How understandable is the trigger to the anger?
Mm-hmm.
How far does the person go in their expression of the anger? Do they have a boundary? For example, in a normal family, a person might be angry and they might want to throw something, but they are careful enough that they don't throw it towards anybody that they care about because they have a filter. They have a little bit of self-control, and they go, I'm really mad, I'm going to throw this, or I'll pick something that I don't care if it breaks, you know? I won't pick my most expensive thing in the room. I will break, you know, my old rusty whatever you call it, you know? So they'll have a little bit of self-control even in their expression of anger that might range at a low level of aggression. But the pathological anger, and I'm sure all of you out there listening don't need me to tell you a lot of what that looks like, but I'll just tell you that it's from a professional standpoint, it's there's often a cold disregard for the human beings in the room and a huge sense of entitlement, and it's often over very trivial things, or most people might think are trivial, like you're wearing a low-cut T-shirt, or like you brought my. I had one person I worked with in a crisis situation where she brought the birthday cake out for her husband during the football game, and he decided that was an act that warranted a homicidal rage and chasing her down the street with a gun. So, you know, that is where you take some small minor thing that actually most people would consider a nice thing. Somebody's giving you a birthday cake and the person is so outraged that it isn't done at the proper time that, you know, they would go into a rage. So you're looking at really the extremes of the reactivity, and the trigger is an insufficient trigger for a normal person to consider reasonable. And also there's a certain cold disregard for the feelings of the person you're angry with.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be a very hot expression of anger, but there's no regard for the other human being.
And Jennifer, I think in your role with the Institute in counseling the survivors, what Dr. Simmons brought up about it being the trigger, an understandable trigger. I mean, this is where we really see our clients where the triggers are not understandable.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's a great distinction that you make to help people understand normal from pathological. In, you know, normal being that anyone else would understand why someone would become angry. You know, somebody drops a valuable vase from their grandmother, there's going to be a little anger. Or your teenager doesn't do the chore, it's going to be a little bit of anger. Any reasonable person would make sense of that.
Exactly.
I think, you know, we have a line we use with clients, when we see pathological behavior, we say, who does that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of inquisitive, like, really? Do you see the disconnect? And that's kind of what I think you're talking about when you talk about that pathological trigger of anger. Why would someone chase someone down, you know, after having a birthday cake presented at the wrong time? Who does that?
Exactly.
Kind of doesn't fit. And that's really important.
And I think for a lot of people with this issue about pathological anger is they no longer are able to read for the irrational trigger. I mean, the longer that they're exposed to this, you know, pathological anger, now they're in a relationship where this person is angry all the time. I mean,
right.
Because at the within the pathology, if you will, of the person is all that reactivity that we know is part of cluster B. After a while, I think they just get to the point where the triggers make sense to them. Normalize the abnormal behavior.
Right, right. You start to really, I think, in adapting to anything in our environment, if we get punished for doing certain behaviors, we will do our best to avoid those behaviors, even if it's unreasonable.
Right.
So if you're living with someone who one day goes absolutely hysterical because you used the wrong salad fork, or gave him a short fork instead of a long fork when he wanted to have his dinner, then you're going to have a lot more anxiety setting the table the next evening. You're going to be very careful about the kind of fork you put down. And the reason for that kind of reaction is it's adaptive. It's our human learning that we want to avoid pain. And so what happens, though, is it makes the healthier person in the relationship, the one who's not raging, start acting unhealthy.
Right.
Do you really need to speed home and hurry up to make sure that, you know, this particular room is straightened up, or all hell's going to break loose? You know, is it you have to go 90 miles an hour on the freeway to get home to make that happen? So you're starting to your behavior starts to get shaped by these unreasonable expectations, and then you start behaving in a way that's not healthy. It's a normal adaptation to a stressor to try to avoid it the next time. The problem is when those things are so capricious and unpredictable and unreasonable, then people's worlds start getting smaller and smaller and narrower, so that pretty soon your whole life is around pleasing that person and you don't have a self anymore. Or trying to avoid the wrath of that person. So you know, that's why you need people need your help. You know, that's why you guys are here.
Yep. You have to be able to spot that.
Like there was even this study once on a real milder level, where they had this classroom where all the students in the class were in on the study, and half of the class would smile at the professor while he was lecturing, and the other half of the class would glare at the professor and absolutely give the professor no positive feedback. And by the end of the day, the professor was only speaking to the side of the room where all of the smiling people were, and didn't even realize it. So it's like you can even shape someone's behavior in 1 hour by whether you give them anger or whether you give them positive feedback. And so we're really reactive, we're really responsive to the way people treat us. And it's a survival skill because we're social beings and we need one another to survive. So it's very, very difficult to live in that with a hostile person. It can be very damaging to our health and our, you know, everything.
So many of our clients, you know, have rolled right from, you know, early childhood, you know, where parents might have had anger issues or, you know, or a pathological personality right into another relationship, you know,
exactly.
with someone in which they've just rolled from one hostile experience, you know, to another.
Right, because it's familiar, right? You think that's the way people are, and it's comfortable. You understand it, but of course, it's not really comfortable.
No, right. No. Jennifer, were you going to make a point?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think when you see what happens to these two people, the woman who is trying to connect with her partner,
right.
And as you mentioned, you know, as humans, that's what we need to do to survive. We need to connect with the people around us. And the trouble comes when you get connected with a pathological and they can't connect with other humans the way we do, and their purpose and how they move in the world is through control.
Exactly.
You know, so you've got kind of two people, completely different purposes, and one with a really good mask. So, you know,
exactly.
it becomes a very volatile situation, you know, where the anger is concerned for her in particular, because she's the one that perceives and receives, and he's just controlling.
Right.
And very often, you know, beyond whatever his convoluted reason is for being angry or whatever the trigger he says is,
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, one of the things we do know about cluster B disorders is the emotional dysregulation, you know,
right.
problems that they have, that there are neurobiological reasons for some of their emotional dysregulation, you know, not necessarily the things that they say are related to their anger, that their inability to regulate their emotions is often, you know, connected to the personality disorder. I mean, for instance, in borderline, we know, you know, one of the problems is emotional dysregulation. Now we know that's true in narcissism and, you know, really the whole cluster B. So there is some biology to some of it too, can't there be?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, we do know that there's a lot of differences in the brains of those, the brain functioning of those with cluster B disorders, psychopaths. There's an they underreact to the suffering of others. We know psychopaths need higher and higher levels of intensity in order to feel anything, and so they often don't feel much in their relationships with other people unless there's something really intense going on. And so that's why sometimes they get bored really easily. So a woman who's really trying to make everything really nice and keep things consistent and stable for her children or to avoid being abused may get really smacked down if she's too predictable, you know, and then there's the person with the psychopathy comes in and wants to just stir things up to get the chaos going, get something exciting
mm-hmm.
happening so they can feel something. And
right.
and that can be really confusing to a woman who actually feels an emotional attachment to him and actually, you know, believes that he feels the same for her in some way. That can be really shocking to learn that you're with someone who really isn't connecting with you like a human being.
Right. And I think that's what a lot of people don't always know about that issue of anger and the emotional regulation problems in some people. It's not always connected to, you know, early childhood trauma, which is what so many of our clients hear, believe, you know, maybe there really was that for the, you know, the angry partner. There may really have been that. Maybe there wasn't. But that sometimes the emotional regulation problems, you know, are beyond, you know, just the earlier childhood events in their life.
Right, and I think that's why sometimes really good women, loving, caring women, can get involved with somebody that they have sympathy for, because maybe he has a sad story to tell about being abused or neglected or abandoned or mistreated, and so she feels the tenderness for him and maybe can connect with some of her own sad feelings from her past and feels like she's made a bond with someone who's wounded a little bit like her but wants to make things better, and you know, you get all that feeling of warmth and connectedness, but what you don't realize is maybe this person really is has something really missing inside that makes it impossible for them to really have empathy or really put themselves in another person's shoes and really have a back and forth reciprocal relationship. They're all really about themselves and feel entitled to just exploiting anyone in their world to get what they want.
And so anger, their anger in the cluster B disorder in the relationship, their anger can come from a number of different places.
Exactly.
So it could be neurochemical imbalances. It could be neurobiological hardwiring problems.
Exactly.
It could be trauma. What else could it be?
It can be a boredom, a need for stimulation. It could be actually cold. They could actually not be angry at all, but need to push a button in order to get what they want.
That's sometimes what I think about, is that when they experience a loss of control.
Yes.
You know, when things are outside of their control, then that's when you often see, in particular, rage at times, but also that more controlled anger.
Exactly. There's a need to feel like they are in charge, and if
right.
they're not in charge. So you'll see, like, I'll give you an example, a client of mine who's boyfriend basically was discussing where they were going to go eat, and he wanted to have hamburgers and she wanted to have pizza because she and her son had had hamburgers that day for lunch, and they wanted to have pizza. And for him, that was that required a huge screaming and yelling, verbally abusive tirade about how selfish she was and how he didn't want to have anything to do with anybody so selfish, and a whole lot of expletives and nasty comments and stomping out and not talking to her for 3 days. So, you know, if you can't even have a disagreement over what you're going to have for dinner,
right.
because this person isn't in control. They aren't getting exactly precisely what they want, because they're kind of emotionally, as you guys probably talked about before, you know, these folks are emotionally under age 2, so emotionally it's all about them. It's, you know, this is what I want, and I want it now, and if you're in the way of what I want, then I don't really care about you, and I'm going to either make you give me what I want, or I'm going to make you pay.
Right. Right.
So it's a level of attachment that's very, very primitive. It's like you're an object.
Yeah.
You're not a whole
right.
Not a person.
Right.
Exactly. And I like what you were saying earlier about, especially in psychopathy, for instance, that the higher level of intensity, that they have to keep raising the bar of level of intensity in order to feel. And we certainly see that in, you know, a lot of the sexual rapists and things like that, where each crime gets more intense than the one before that. But even outside of all of that violence, within that context of anger, we often see that in the relationship. And in fact, in our book, Women Who Love Psychopaths, I talked about, you know, one of the red flags, you know, for me, whether or not this is a pathological love relationship, has a lot to do with the intensity that's experienced in the relationship. And just as you had pointed out, that their need for higher and higher levels of intensity, and what's more intense than anger?
Right.
In order to feel, is that, you know, is part of the reason why I think, especially with cluster B relationships, that the anger does increase over the length of the relationship, that it does keep getting more intense. Their anger gets more intense, the relationship becomes more intense to experience. Because, like I said, what's more intense to experience than anger, and especially what's more intense for someone who has PTSD to experience than someone else's anger?
And I
just really see that playing out in those cluster B relationships, that whole level of increasing levels of anger as part of, you know, the disordered partner way of feeling anything.
Exactly, and sometimes it's used as a release too. It's just like I'm pent up. I feel something discomfort. I'm not really liking my day. I don't like how my day is going. This is boring. I don't like the way this is happening. I need to shake things up. I need to make something happen here. What can I do? You know, it's almost that kind of a primitive way of thinking. And so, you know, sometimes a person can just start with a violent act or start with some. It's like I've got a remote control in my hand and I don't know which button to push, but I got to push something because I don't like the way I feel. Mm-hmm. And so that's how a lot of fights can start with these couples, is just this sort of really restless, agitated discomfort that they have an inability to manage or control and contain, and no insight too. That's mm-hmm. one of the characteristics, is they're not able to really look at themselves and go, wow, you know, I really do have a problem here. They're usually very good at justifying everything.
Mm-hmm. So as people are listening and sort of comparing, you know, their relationship to what we have been discussing,
mm-hmm.
in a perfect world, you know, who are the ones that benefit from anger management treatment? I mean, who can we help and who can't we help?
That's a great question, Sandra. I actually kind of think of it as sort of three categories. You have your people with normal anger that usually won't need to go to therapy for an anger problem because they're able to kind of work things out. That's like I described in the beginning. Then you'll have your pathological anger at the other extreme, where it's just, you know, out of control and abusive. And then we have this third category called problem anger. And problem anger is kind of characterized by similar things to normal anger, in that it flares up quickly, it flares up frequently, might be slower to calm down, might be a higher intensity and or frequency than most people would find reasonable. And it's usually followed by behavior that can cause problems in their work or interpersonal relationships. So that behavior might be, again, you're screaming and yelling, or you're using foul language, or you're using condescending language that hurts the other person's feelings. You're being unreasonably demanding, that sort of thing. The difference with problem anger and pathological anger is often it's usually accompanied by feelings of regret, remorse, shame, embarrassment, or some feeling that some part of what they did while they were angry was not the way they like to see themselves, not the way they want to behave. they are able to kind of look at themselves after they cool down, usually not in the heat of the moment, but after they cool down, they're usually able to go, oh, man, I don't really mean those things I said. I can't even believe I told you that, you know, I never loved you. I love you, and I really, that's a horrible thing that I said, and I have no excuse for saying that, and I need to work on this. I have a problem. So they might recognize that some part of what their behavior when they're angry is not appropriate and is harmful to the people that they love and care about. And it also doesn't fit in with their sense of who they are. They like to think of themselves as a good person, and most of the time they are, maybe. Most of the time they do have a sense of responsibility for others, sense of responsibility for their loved ones. People in a pathological relationship, they don't have a sense of responsibility for the impact of their actions on other people.
They blame everybody else for their...
Yes, they're not responsible for really anything. So when you have a sense of responsibility and you have a sense of yourself as a good, decent person that cares about others, you don't want to behave this way. And so there is a certain amount of discomfort with your behavior. And so people with problem anger can behave really badly, but they are workable because they don't like that. They don't. That's not the way they want to be in life. So that's the part. People with problem anger are really the bulk of our practice. They might get referred by their boss at work or by their wife, or they've been told if they don't deal with their anger problem, they're going to lose their family. And they come in and they just feel horrible. And they, and they want to work, and they're real eager to learn some skills to regulate their emotions better, and that sort of thing. And they're really ready to hear the harm that they've caused, and make some amends or do the repair work necessary.
And
it doesn't mean it's easy for them, and it doesn't mean that they don't still get angry or, you know, that sort of thing, but they can really work on it and get to a place where they're actually much much more in the normal range of anger.
And what is a red flag for you when you think, oh, man, I'm not holding my breath on this one? In terms of, what are red flags for you when you think, I'm not sure this person is going to get a lot of benefit from treatment?
I think it's just that cold disregard for the feelings of others. I'll often see them, sometimes it's quite apparent they when the other person talks about how hurt they are that you called me this or you called me that, they might laugh. And they might go, oh, women, they just always make a big deal out of words, you know, that's ridiculous, you know, or it's amusing to them. There isn't a sense of, oh, man, I've really hurt you. I've really damaged this relationship. I've made you afraid of me. I've made you feel uncomfortable and hurt, and I've wounded your ego. I've hurt your self-esteem, you know. There's none of that. There's just almost a coldness, basically a coldness.
Right.
And a lack of human empathy. And you know, there people who are confronted with the damage they do when they have problem anger, they're not comfortable hearing about it. You know, it makes them feel uncomfortable, and they feel criticized, they feel picked on, but they also feel really bad that they've hurt someone. You know, and they'll sit here and sometimes they'll cry, you know. I can't believe I said that to my daughter. I can't believe I did that to my wife, that she is so afraid of me now, you know. and afraid that I'm going to yell at her or afraid that I'm going to say mean things. You know, I don't want to have this kind of relationship. I don't want her to feel that way about me. You know, they care about how you feel about them.
Right.
And yeah. So that's somebody you can really work with, right? Because they have that sense of reciprocity in a relationship. It's a about give and take, and it's about, and they're responsible for the impact of the behavior. And and they have a little bit of that responsibility. They don't necessarily have the self-control yet, but they have a desire for it.
And Jennifer, a lot with our clients, because I can hear, you know, what our clients often say, which is they've been, you know, they had gone to marriage counseling because he or she did have an anger problem. They expressed remorse. You know, sometimes they wear really good masks.
I've seen that. Yeah, I've seen that too. But you know, they might say the right words, but when you look at their nonverbal, they're almost mildly amused. They're going through the motions. They're going through the
How do you handle that, Gina, as a professional with a couple where the partner presents and says that he wants help, and you start to recognize over time, or maybe the first time, that there is the disconnect in him? How do you handle that as a professional?
Well, it varies from person to person, but if I see those signs, those nonverbal signs of, you say you're sorry, but you got a smile on your face. You're looking actually kind of like you're having a really good time here, and look at your wife. She's crying. She's shaking.
Yep.
And you're just sitting there like you're just having the most fun. You know, what the hell's going on with you? Because I don't believe a word you just said. And I'll say something like that to them, and then they'll start to snap to attention a little bit. You know, isn't going to change them, but it often helps the woman see that his behavior is really not remorseful. That's not what remorse looks like. Remorse is an awful feeling. It is a sick feeling in your gut, and you might make you shake. It might make you want to throw up. It might make you want to cry. But it is not a sitting there smirking, I'm sorry, man, I didn't want you to feel bad, honey. Oh, let's go have sex, you know. It's not that kind of a thing.
That's not remorse.
No, this isn't remorse. This is you pushing some buttons just to get what you want, and you're just saying whatever it's going to take to manipulate the situation to your advantage.
We talk about... that in the psychopath book that, you know...
It's a great book, by the way. Yeah, it's a great book.
Oh, thank you. Thank
I recommend it to my clients.
Oh, that's great. You know, one of the things that we try to point out when women are trying to differentiate between those people who can change, whether it's anger they need to change or whether it's something else that they need to change, that the three things, you know, that need to be considered in that is the inability to develop an insight about how their negative, you know, behavior affects other people. The inability to sustain positive change. Anyone can change for a couple of weeks. They can say the right thing in therapy, but, you know, 6 months from now, you know, has his or her behavior, you know, positive behaviors that they said they were going to make, have they been able to sustain those? And the inability to develop any emotional or spiritual depth.
Right.
And like you said, sort of that callousness, that the smirking over the power and control that, you know, when we are looking at, does the person, you know, bring to this endeavor the ability to change? Those are some key things that we always look for. And I know you brought up the issue of insight, and I think that's key. That when you're dealing with someone who not only has pathological anger, but they are pathological, you know, one of the the greatest impacts in their deficit, their own deficits, because of the disorder is, you know, their insight. It's just crippled. And, you know, how
they're not interested in having it too, because again, when you look at the way people behave, you know, what motivates them? And if someone, you know, people who are interested in insight, they want to know themselves better. It's usually because they want to understand how people work and how they work in relation to others. And so, you know, the reason why I might want to understand myself better is to figure out how I can be a better person and be more effective and be more effective in my relationships. Otherwise, why have insight? Because, you know, you don't really need to know about yourself. You just need to know about how do you get what you want.
Right.
And that's basically the psychopath's MO. It's everything in their thinking, everything in their motivation is about how do I get what I want.
Right.
It's not about what kind of a person am I, how can I improve myself, how can I make my relationships better, how can I make my wife happy.
Right.
And so none of that figures in the motivational structure.
Right.
And you can see that over and over again in repeated patterns of behavior.
Do you see in normal anger and problem anger, do you see sustained positive change over time? Or would you expect down the road, if there was problem anger, obviously, would you expect there to be a relapse? Or would you expect to see sustained change?
Well, we do see sustained change. We have people go through our anger management program. We also have a graduate course for people who want to keep on going with it. And we see sustained change. We see that reported in their marriages are doing better and their families are happier.
I
think a big, another big difference between problem anger and pathological anger is people with problem anger often have an underlayment of anxiety or internal conflict. You know, they might have some wounds from their childhood. Maybe they were raised in an alcoholic family or something, and they feel some internal conflict. And so sometimes that internal conflict bubbles up into explosions of anger. And when you lower their nervous system arousal through things like exercise, meditation, having a community of friends they can talk to, a support group, that lowers the sort of internal anxiety, and that can actually help them manage their anger more effectively. So we often, you know, encourage people to do meditation and exercise and stress relieving things like that, so that their baseline level of anxiety is much lower. Most people with problem anger have a higher than normal level of anxiety, nervous tension. They're often very self-neglectful. You know, they skip meals, they don't eat right, they, you know, and they're just running around just ragged. And so they're quick to blow up.
Jennifer, I think it's important that internal conflict idea in someone with problem anger versus a pathological whose foundation is paranoia and accusation. It isn't so much that internal struggle of I'm good, I'm bad, right?
Right.
That to them is not a struggle. That's a fool.
Exactly.
Right? So, but someone else who has problem anger, they see that as a problem. They see I'm good, I'm bad, and that's unsettling to them.
Exactly.
Right?
It's a pretty clear difference when you really look at the person's pattern of behavior.
Right.
When you're motivated by anxiety and you have some internal conflict, and really to have internal conflict, you have to have a little bit of insight. Right?
I want
to do this, but I really want to do that. And, you know, I don't like myself when I'm this way, but, you know,
And conscience.
Anxiety shows you got a conscience. Now,
yeah,
it's different from paranoia, and I'm glad you brought that up, because paranoia is not anxiety, right?
Right.
Paranoia is a really a sense of alienation, which most people with pathological anger feel completely detached and alienated from other people. And paranoids have delusions or suspicions of that everyone's out to get them. And so, you know, when they're at the psychotic level, of course, it's easier to spot because they're, you know, imagining things that aren't there and so forth. But it can be at a personality disordered level where they're pathologically jealous, for example, or they're paranoid about imagining someone cheating on them or trying to steal from them or all of these negative things that they believe other people are doing. And they're not able to take feedback from other people because they have that brokenness inside of them that, you know, they are unable to actually put themselves in someone else's shoes and imagine that.
And I think the problem anxiety that we've just been talking about sounds so much like the women coming out of these pathological love relationships who have various levels of stress disorder and PTSD and say, I don't recognize myself anymore. Now I'm explosive. Now I can't manage my anger, all the irritability that comes up from PTSD. And I'm really glad we talked about this because for the women that are listening who when we were posting about the show, the comments on Facebook we were getting is, I need to find out about my anger now, you know, and maybe I'm pathological, you know, because now I act this way. And so I'm glad we touched on this because I think it really helps to illuminate, even for the women, that their problem, anxiety.
They might be, I'm sorry to cut you off there. They might be more in the problem anger category because to be even concerned about that suggests that you actually care, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So that means you're not a pathological. You maybe have a problem now because you've got anxiety from being abused and you're trying to recover and you're still healing and you need retreats, right? You need retreats. You need central nervous system. Calmness.
Calming.
You learn to generate through meditation, exercise, support groups, the good relationships with healthy people, and maybe being in a community that's more wholesome, where people are trying to do good things. That's very healing.
Nice.
Habitat for Humanity. You know, all those kinds of things.
Exactly. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation tonight with Dr. Gina Simmons from Snyder Family Services. We are getting close to the bewitching hour and winding this up, and I know that we could talk for another hour as we were heading into looking at problem anger, but this has been so good. I'm so glad that you joined us tonight. And for more information about Dr. Gina Simmons, go by her website at manageangerdaily.com and check her out. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sandra, and thank you, Jennifer. It's been great talking with you both.
Thanks, Gina, so much.
We hope you'll come back and we can pick it up and maybe talk about PTSD and the anger that's often generated from that type of anxiety.
I would love to. Thank you.
All right, everybody, thank you for joining us tonight. Everybody from On Remote Radio.
Well, it's gonna feel bright.